While you're listening, go to arcpodnet.com/members and support our efforts. Let's get to the show.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 184.
On today's show, we talk about the origin of language in Mesopotamia, China, and Mesoamerica.
Let's dig a little deeper into the logographic representation of this show. What picture would represent this show? I don't know. Probably just chaos.
Oh, I don't know. Like a trowel, maybe?
A trowel. That's stupid. Let's find out.
Okay.
Welcome, everybody, to The Archaeology Show. How's it going?
Pretty good.
So we're here at Glacier Meadow RV Park, which is not near a glacier, but it is near a meadow.
No, it is. Like those mountains right over there.
Right, but I can't see any.
That's Glacier National Park. So on the other side of those mountains, you'd probably see some glaciers.
Right, but I can't see any here.
No.
So I think it's misnamed. But either way, we're just at the south side of Glacier National Park. We're headed into the park today after this recording, actually, and we're going to stay there for about a week. So maybe we'll get some history up there at the visitor centers.
I know. I'm so excited because, so at first we weren't sure we were going to be able to get a camping spot in the park because we just don't plan far enough ahead to be with all the people sitting at their computers 6 months ago to grab these spots. So what I did is I booked us a tour because you can only get in the park if you have like a reservation or a tour or vehicle reservation, and all that stuff is booked out. So I booked us a tour because it was available, and it's with a Native American, a member of the Blackfeet tribe up here in Montana. And they're going to do a Glacier National Park like Native American spin on a tour of the area. So we're really excited about that. We'll probably have a little bit of not really a review so much as of what our experience was like in our next episode, hopefully.
It sounds like an episode writing itself. I would venture to say the writing's on the wall for that one. You know where else the writing was on the wall?
Oh my God.
Pretty much.
I don't know why I didn't see where you were going with that.
Pretty much all over the ancient world.
Yeah.
So, we're going to do a deep dive because on our last episode, if you heard that, one of our articles was about the recent potential decipherment, if that is a word.
Translation?
Oh, yeah, translation. But deciphering,
once
you decipher and you understand, then you translate, I feel like.
Yes, that's true, because they have not fully translated.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
Sure, sure. So you got to understand what the symbols mean before you can translate.
The made-up decipherment word.
So the decipherment of linear Elamite, TAS 183, we'll have a link to that in the show notes, or it's just like the last episode that we recorded.
Yeah, and it's the third segment, I think.
Yeah. There's so much about ancient writing, and we were both kind of wondering, well, what else hasn't been deciphered, and where has writing developed, and who's done what, and so we just kind of did a deep dive on that article and the whole topic of ancient writing for this episode.
Yeah, I think both of us have always found the study of languages or linguistics super interesting, but also like really complicated, and there's just a lot of different paths that language has taken in the different parts of the world. Mm-hmm. And I know when we were talking about that article last week, we're talking about it and I'm like, man, I really don't know anything about any of this stuff. I just have like that base knowledge of like language started with the Sumerians, and like that was sort of where my knowledge ended. So it was really fun to like deep dive this and find out the actual origins and where it happened, where it developed independently around the world.
Yeah, I'm looking at this, you know, kind of just looking at what writing even means. You know, is writing symbols? Is it pictures? Is it taking multiple symbols and putting them together to form what we would now call words or concepts or something like that? Writing can mean different things to different people. And if you understand the meaning that's being conveyed, then, well, I would venture to say that's writing. Like rock art. We don't understand a lot of what the pictographic representations of rock art mean because we're not in the mind of the ancient peoples that produced it. But were they just symbols for, you know, ancient hunting magic, which people always say, or something like that? Or could they have actually conveyed
like been communication
messages?
Yeah.
Could they have said, you know, this is what's going on here, you know, beware, something like that or whatever.
I mean, there's a fair amount of rock art in this world, and you just can't assume that all of it is related to sacred things and ritual. And I imagine some of it must have just been like basic communication. Like, hey, we found a lot of buffalo here. You know, go here to find more buffalo or whatever, you know?
It could have been, but also the rarity of rock art, because while there is a lot of rock art in the world, it's relatively rare compared to the number of places there could be rock art.
Yeah, right? That's true.
And it's also, I wouldn't say difficult to create, but it's time consuming, you know, and you have to have kind of a head for it. And to be honest, one of the things I love about looking at rock art, especially the ones that are supposed to represent like animals and stuff, I'm like, oh yeah, that's definitely how I would draw a buffalo. Like,
you're not going to be great rudimentary. At it.
like stick figure buffalo man is exactly what I would do. But so that linear Elamite, again, it might prove to be one of the oldest written language that is based on syllables.
Yeah.
So independent pieces that represent words.
Right.
And some of the earliest forms of writing include what's called logograms, which is using pictures to represent words. Mm-hmm. So if you have a like ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics, if you've got a picture of a bird, it probably means something related to a bird.
Right.
You know, something like that. Or, well, I don't know if hieroglyphics directly translates to stuff like that, but they did use pictures of things to represent other things.
Yeah, I think it was a little bit of both too. A lot of these languages used the logograms, which were the pictures, and then they also would have images that represented sounds that you could put together into words, basically. A lot of these ancient languages included both types of things going on.
And, you know, as I'm reading kind of our next note here, we're going to have to deep dive the Phoenicians at some point.
Yeah, they're pretty cool, right?
We owe a lot to them, to the modern world, right?
Right.
Because the first fully formed phonetic alphabet, we'll get back to that word, is thought to have come from the use of Phoenician traders around 1100 BCE, which makes sense because they were trading all over the Mediterranean.
Yeah. They had to communicate.
You know, when you're dealing with contracts and purchases and things like that, you just need a common frame of reference. Mm-hmm. And it would make sense that they would help to promote or develop that kind of thing based on stuff that they'd seen so people would understand. And if you want to trade with the Phoenicians, you're probably going to have to learn their language.
Yeah, totally. You know? And I mean, of course, there's the verbal language, which I feel like that was probably pretty easy for people to pick up and share when you're just verbally trying to communicate with somebody. But when you talk about trading and, you know, all of the things that go along with that and trust in people, you need to have proof of what you're trading or what you agreed to do. And that's where the written language part came in. I'm sure that in order to believe and trust in the people that you were trading with, they had to figure out a way to write down the things that they were doing.
Right. And what I said, we'd get back to the word phonetic. It just looks like it's a derivative of the word Phoenician.
Uh-huh.
Like their phonetic alphabet would have been the Phoenician alphabet. But I honestly don't know if that's just a coincidence in
I don't think it is. I think it is because it was the first one came from the Phoenicians. So that's where that word comes from.
Well, when we deep dive the Phoenicians, we'll find out.
I know, so, right?
Yeah. So anyway, one of the other cool things about writing and looking at this whole topic is I'm always concerned with origins. That's what I love about archaeology.
Yeah.
Where did the first things come from? That's why when I first started getting into anthropology in college, my first love was paleoanthropology. Mm-hmm. And if Arizona State hadn't been such jerks and not admitted me, me and the other 8,000 people that applied that year.
Don't you have to apply like at least three times before you even have a chance of getting accepted?
I just kind of gave up after the first year because anyway, it's a long story, but I looked at the people that they actually brought in and they were looking for young. I was already 10 years older than most students.
Yeah.
They were looking for young people with excellent GPAs until they got, and I had a decent GPA, but I wasn't like a superstar standout student. And they kind of had to do that because they got
so many applicants.
They get hundreds and hundreds of applicants to their paleoanthropology program, their graduate program and PhD. And they take like four every year.
It's
stupid.
Totally.
So anyway, that's why they're a great school.
But you do have a love of the topic. You always have. You did when I met you. You had just come back from
Africa
working at Old Ivy Gorge. So I know that you have a love for that. And I've been pestering you about this for years. And I'm going to say it on the podcast now because it's going to make it real.
I'll edit it out.
No, you're not editing this one. I am. But I really want to do a paleoanthropology focused, maybe couple of episodes or whatever it takes for us
to
cover.
A whole podcast.
I know you'd love to do a whole podcast. We don't have the bandwidth for a whole new podcast right now. But
if you're listening to this show and you are a paleoanthropologist, like you're in this space, we'll give you a show.
Right?
We have the space. You just have to record.
Yeah, you can even have a built-in co-host in you because you just want to like get on there and talk about it.
Yeah.
But anyway, for TAS, for our show, I really do want you to do us a like deep dive episode on it. So, all right. If anybody else wants to hear that, write into Chris at archaeologypodcastnetwork.com and tell him how much you want to hear that because I don't really have the skill set for that, but you definitely do.
That's right. All right. So
there you go.
Regarding first things.
Yes.
Just a really quick overview here. It seems like according to some research that writing systems have been developed independently at least 4 times in human history. And it's more than likely a lot
probably more than that.
Yeah, a lot more.
Like
than that.
Boiling it down to 4 is being pretty simple about it, because within those 4, it was probably multiple independent times as well.
It could have been. Yeah. And also there's other writings, which we'll talk about later, that, you know, they could have developed a long time ago, but it's on materials we simply don't have any evidence for anymore.
Yeah.
The perishable materials.
I know. Yeah, it's so crazy. That missing majority thing. I know we've talked about that before, but when you write on wood or silk or bamboo or whatever, which it will come up a lot when we talk about Asia, that stuff is just gone. Yeah. It doesn't last through time. It just degrades. So,
So some of the earliest ones, again, these independently developed ones that we know about, Mesopotamia, they used cuneiform between 3400 and 3300 BCE. And then 1300 BCE, the Shang Dynasty in China, between 900 and 600 BCE, some cultures of Mesoamerica, and I say some cultures because there was kind of like a lot of independent writing down there.
Yep.
And then others like the Indus River Valley and Rapa Nui, otherwise known as Easter Island.
Mm-hmm.
But again, these remain undeciphered. And when they remain undeciphered and somewhat chaotic in some cases, like they're just symbols on a thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, is this a language or is this just symbolic representation of something which may or may not be an actual written language?
Yeah. I found this when I was researching Asian languages, actually, but there's a really early like language in big quotation marks, which is just like a series of symbols. And people are like, well, is it a language or is it just like what you would use to sign a document if you didn't have a written language, kind of like putting an X if you didn't know how to sign your name.
Yeah.
So you have to be really careful to distinguish between that sort of thing, which is totally valid, but it's not quite a language, and then actual real languages that were used for making sentences and communicating.
That's how languages develop, though.
It is. They start with that, right?
Yeah. If the symbol, you know, wedge shape with a cross on the top of it means grog, you know, grog made this, then that becomes the word grog, you know, at some point, and you just kind of associate it with that.
Sure.
So and then if you make something that's grog-like, you need a word for, you need a symbol for like, you know, maybe it's the grog's symbol with a circle around it.
Right.
Yeah. So,
oh, you just developed a language. Look at that. You go.
I know. So I'll talk to James Cameron. Anyway.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So a little bit of a refresher on some of these. Again, cuneiform, about 2900 BCE, give or take. We said 3400 to 3300 was the development.
That was origins of it, right?
Yeah. That was the origins of cuneiform, 3400 to 3300.
Yeah.
But like the kind of the height of it was the Sumerians, what is now in present day Iraq. Again, another people that just like gave us so much that we have today.
Right? I know.
Anyway, they were making the wedge shaped marks in wet clay with a reed. And again, that's known as cuneiform. But the interesting thing is, again, the development of this stuff. So you got people very tediously going pluck, 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 like they're doing these things. And they're like, this has got to be quicker. Or you just get somebody that's a little sloppy with it. Right. And or maybe the clay was too wet and it just kind of rolled together.
Yeah. And I've seen some images of it, too. And I like can't even imagine how they were able to decipher that, because it all looks the same to me. Mm-hmm. Like that, it's not like some of the other languages that are like really distinct symbols that are, it's obvious to see that somebody was communicating something specific here.
Right.
Those reed punctures kind of are just, they're very, they're hard to see what they could be saying.
Well, and again, it's like wet clay. Like if the clay's too wet, it could just like fall in on itself. But anyway, so the reeds have kind of an elliptical shape to them, like a boomerang shape. Yeah. And over time, those curves were sort of eliminated, probably as they used different materials to make the symbols. They realized that, hey, we can make this naturally with this, but that's kind of hard to find and come by and maintain. So let's make them with these. And so the signs were simplified. And then the direct connection between the look of some of the pictograms and the original object reference was lost, which means that maybe something like, again, using hieroglyphs looked like a bird, but the fact that it means bird was lost.
Oh,
that kind
of
thing, right? Because the shape changed kind of away from a bird enough, right?
Yeah.
Not quite the same with cuneiform, but an easy to understand example.
Mm-hmm.
And also during this period, the writing was read from top to bottom and then shifted from left to right in horizontal lines, which is how we read today. Like how English is read anyway.
Okay.
And in a lot of languages are read.
Yeah.
But also the symbols, because of that, were sort of realigned again through time and then rotated 90 degrees counterclockwise, which is, seems like a pretty big shift.
That's so crazy how that developed. I almost can't picture it. But
I know. The cool thing is the last datable document in cuneiform is an astronomical text from 75 AD. because it became more of a, as people were using other languages, it became more of a clerical or, you know, sort of, I don't know, I don't want to say like scientific elite, but, you know, a language that wasn't used by very many people.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And so, it was the basis for a lot of other languages that kind of developed out of that region too, well, right?
Yeah, and I kind of feel like by 75 AD, it was kind of like Latin is today.
Yeah, like, exactly.
Nobody speaks Latin, but we still use it in scientific contexts and things like that.
It's the root of a lot of words that we use today in all of our different languages.
And and even some services, like Catholic services, are still done in Latin.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
So in Egypt, the writing can date back to about 3250 BCE. And rock inscriptions again. And they were like huge symbols on rock and they resemble what became hieroglyphs. So again, pictures that become basically words to represent what these things are. Some of those images on those really early ones were over a meter high.
And they were influenced by cuneiform as well, right? Like it had kind of like bled over a little bit. And
I imagine
that
seen
helped
it.
Develop the Egyptian hieroglyph language as well.
I mean, they weren't that far away, to be honest. The first writing in ink using reed brushes, again, reeds, just like dominating here, was found in Egypt, which is kind of cool. And it was known by the Greek term hieratic, or which is a priestly script.
Essentially,
it's like cursive hieroglyphics.
Right.
The earliest Chinese writing, which we're going to deep dive here in the next segment, was 1300 to 1050 BCE from the Shang Dynasty. And again, the Mesoamerican systems, there was actually a number of them developed anywhere around 900 BCE or so. Probably not all at the same time, of course, but they had what I guess linguists would call open systems and closed systems of writing. Open systems of writing are not linked to grammatical and sound structures of specific languages, which from what I understood from that basically means that it's a system of writing that's a little bit more understandable by other groups around you.
Like images that make sense to everybody.
Kind of. And then there's closed systems where the sound and grammatical structures are tied to specific languages. So just different forms of communication, basically. There was only four closed system Maya books, closed systems writing Maya books that survive from pre-colonial period. And then fewer than 20 overall survive at all. We're going to talk about that a little bit later.
Yeah, we will. Yeah.
And then finally, some of the big undeciphered scripts in the world are Vinca, which is Old European, Indus or Harappa script, Proto-Elamite and Old Elamite, which is like Linear Elamite, which is what we talked about. That one's pretty much done.
Yeah.
But lists aren't correcting that yet.
Yeah. Well, because it's still like debated whether or not it's actually like
plus they're not
going
to like update all these articles.
It's like it's like that deciphered versus translated thing you're talking about. Like they might have deciphered it and they definitely haven't fully translated things. So
And then we've got Linear A, the Phaistos disc, which is kind of cool. The Voynich manuscript, the Rohonc codex, and Rongo Rongo. I really want to learn Rongo Rongo. I'm going to see if that's on Duolingo. I don't think it is. Yeah.
So many undeciphered languages. That's crazy. I wonder if it's lack of resources to learn from or if it's just so complicated that it just isn't something that we've been able to decipher yet.
Well, I don't know about you, but let's try to answer that question with some ancient Chinese wisdom back in a minute. Hey everyone, Chris Webster from the APN here. We have used a number of solutions for recording our podcast with interesting people from around the world. None have worked better than Zencastr. For the last several years, we've been using Zencastr for high-quality recordings that are easy to do and put little to no stress on the guest. And now, Zencastr has high-quality video and even automatic transcription. So click the link in the show notes or head over to zencastr.com/pricing and use the code TAS to get 30% off your first 3 months of the Pro Plan. If you're starting a podcast anytime soon, it's totally worth it. Again, click the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months. And they even give a little back to us when you do.
Keep this conversation going by joining our members-only Slack team. There's always vibrant conversations going on over there between members and hosts about the topics we're podcasting about and more. Also get access to our back catalog of bonus material and ad-free shows. You get all this for $7.99 a month or less than $80 US per year if you get the annual subscription. Support archaeological education and outreach by supporting the APN. Go to arcpodnet.com/members for details. That's arcpodnet.com/members.
Are you listening to this podcast and thinking you'd like to start your own podcast and don't know where to start? Well, Chris Webster, that's me. I'm founder of the APN, and I started podcasting back in 2011. You can learn from my years of experience, and you can do it at your own pace. Head over to propodcastnow.com and click the Learn to Podcast image. My 6 to 8 hour self-guided course will take you from show inception to your first episode, and you'll learn the tools you need to keep it all going and prevent pod fading. That's a real term. You can have access to the materials for as long as you want, and if you stay in for 3 months at least, you'll have lifetime access to the graduates Slack team so you can talk to other people that have taken the course and are managing their own podcasts. Again, head over to propodcastnow.com and click Learn to Podcast. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 184. We're talking about ancient writing, and we talked in general about a bunch in the last segment, but now we're going to focus on a couple for the following two segments with a bonus, too. Don't forget to listen to the bonus segment.
I know, I'm excited about the bonus, but, you know, we decided to do ancient Chinese and then the Mayan script for our next two segments, and I think we decided to do that because the Sumerian language, the cuneiform, and then also Egyptian hieroglyphics, it just kind of seems like those have gotten more play. And like people have heard of those, right? People know what they look like. You can envision those Egyptian hieroglyphics if you think about it because of movies and pop culture and stuff like that. So I didn't know as much about the Chinese languages and then the Mayan script. So we figured let's do those because they're less known to us. So that'll be more interesting, more fun.
Right.
So the ancient Chinese script, there's some disagreement among experts, obviously, because there's always disagreement among experts. But generally, the accepted beginnings of writing in China occur during the Shang Dynasty from 1600 to 1046 BCE. That year range is what the Shang Dynasty range is. And so it developed sometime during that dynasty.
Right.
And it is, like we mentioned in the first segment, it's really hard to know because of this whole missing majority thing where we don't have any examples of the perishable material that they were writing on, like the wood, bamboo, and silk. And we know that they use those materials a lot in China.
It seems incomprehensible to me that something even called a dynasty, a government that is in charge of so many people, could actually do that without some form of tracking.
Yeah, they had to.
Right.
They had to develop something, right?
Yeah.
Because they had to keep track of the people.
But that also tells me, like, you know, this wasn't the first Chinese dynasty, right? Like, there must have been stuff before that, and we just don't have examples of it, you know?
Yeah. So. Well, like we mentioned in the first segment, there's some early pottery sherds that date to like 4500 to 3750 BCE. They have markings on them. They've identified like 20 or so different markings. But most people believe that those are like markings of ownership rather than language, like we were saying, an X as your signature kind of a situation. But like you said, I mean, that could have been the beginnings of a language.
I'm sure it was.
And that was 4,000 years ago or 4,500. So
because symbols of ownership still mean, you know, that person has a name that they're called by, right?
Yeah.
And that symbol becomes the physical representation of that sound of what that person was called by, right? So if I draw a trowel and that means Chris, you know, then trowel means the syllable. The syllable becomes the syllable Chris.
Right.
You know, and that's what that ends up being. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about one of the coolest things that we came across in our research. The oracle bones.
That's right.
So for many centuries, fragments of bones were found by farmers and then sold and used for Chinese medicine as dragon bones.
They kind of still are.
Yeah, they probably still are because there's a lot of mystical stuff that goes on in that part of the world. But it wasn't until 1899 that scholar Wang Yurong recognized the characters carved into the surface of some of these bones as early writing.
Yeah.
And that kind of snowballed into like, well, what is this early writing? What were they doing? Why is it carved into bones? And, you know, they have answered some of those questions.
And these oracle bones were generally used. I mean, it wasn't just any old bone.
No, it had to be big enough, right?
Yeah, generally like the shoulder blades of oxen, which I can imagine
are just like
huge, like encyclopedias. Yeah. Just so you can put a lot on there.
Right.
And then also plastron of turtles. And plastron is, if I'm not mistaken, the undershell.
Yeah. That like flat part.
Yeah. Because the underside of a turtle is also a shell.
Mm-hmm.
A little softer than the harder outer shell that you already know. But we used to find those down in Miami. Mm-hmm. All the turtle bones.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So the way it happened is that someone would want to know the future. Knowing the future was really, really important to Chinese culture. And they thought they could know the future. But
it's important to everybody. Some people just think they can figure it out.
Yeah, exactly. So they would go to these diviner guys, basically an ancient psychic. And the diviner would carve their question, whatever it might be, into a bone. And then heat that bone up. When the bone cracks, the lines that formed would be how they interpreted answer to the question.
Yeah.
So like if the king wants to go hunting tomorrow, he'd go to the diviner, say, should I go hunting tomorrow? And then the way the bone cracks, he would decide whether or not to actually go hunting. And I guess a lot rided on the diviner's answer, because like if he did go hunting and then like didn't catch anything, that would be really bad for the diviner because he was supposed to be able to catch something.
So basically ancient Chinese magic eight ball.
Yeah, totally. I bet things went really bad for diviners sometimes when they were wrong, because, you know, it is still just guessing. Yeah. But so the oracle bones were used like this by everybody, low, high class. Everybody was going to see these guys all throughout the Shang Dynasty and into the next one, the Zhao Dynasty, where it was replaced by the I Ching. And just really quickly, the I Ching, it's another form of divination. Mm-hmm. And it does involve writing a little bit. It's a written text of hexagrams that was used to interpret the meaning of a pattern made by the person who is asking the question, and they throw these yarrow sticks onto the table, and then the diviner interprets what the arrangement of them means using that hexagram thing. So, yeah.
Sounds like those diviners could kind of make up the rules and everybody else had to listen to them.
I know, totally, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was how the oracle bones and that all the stuff for divination seems to have had a great influence on the roots of language, right? Also for governing these larger cities that were starting to develop too. Like you said, they had to have a way to keep control of the government and the people and everything. So all of that seemed to kind of influence it. But there is a very specific evolution of the different scripts in China. The first one is Jiguwen, and it dates to 1600 BCE to 1000 BCE. It's mostly pictographic, and it relied on images to represent the question or idea. And there's like 2,500 to 3,000 characters in that language. Yeah. So many characters, right?
Yep. Yeah. Then the next one was, we're going to butcher all these words,
I know,
by the way.
We'll do our best here.
Yeah, Dazhuan, which was 1100 to 700 BCE. And that was known as the Greater Seal Script, which was also pictographic, but it had a lot more defined characters.
Which is crazy to have even more than 3,000 characters, but...
Yeah, I don't know how you learn all those.
I know, right?
Yeah.
So then after that comes the Zhizhuan, which dates to about 700 BCE, and it's known as the Lesser Seal Script.
Yeah.
Now, this one was getting more logographic, so the symbols represented concepts, not objects so much, like they did in the past.
Yeah.
And this one is actually technically still in use today, so...
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then you had Li Shu, which was from 500 BCE to 220 CE.
Mm-hmm.
And this one was known as the Clerky Script, which I'm not sure what's going on there.
It's such a fun name.
Yeah. It was used during the Qin and Han dynasties and developed to help document government affairs. And it's also logographic, so picture based.
Mm-hmm. That one, I think, is what the language as it is today. Well, not really today, because the Chinese language has really developed a lot.
Right.
But the characters that you can think of when you think of Chinese language, they developed out of this.
It makes me wonder how you develop new words in this language today. Like, what is the word for internet? You know what I mean? Like, how do you just...
Yeah.
It's not... I don't know. I don't understand it.
I know. Yeah. It is hard to understand. And the Chinese language is really, really unique. We'll get to that in a minute here. But so... The language that they're developing here, though, it's not just for government. And some of the most beautiful, like, artistic expression came out of this language. We've got poetry and prose, and it was really a language of art. And part of that is because it was also a language for the elite too. Yeah. So it wasn't really used by everyday people until like the mid 20th century when it got a little bit more standardized and mm-hmm. easier for people, everybody to learn. It was more of a elite language and artistic language.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And part of that is because unlike the rest of the world, the dominant script, it remained logographic rather than moving into phonetic, which right. is what most of the other dominant languages of the world are based on. And I thought this was so interesting, but it's in part because the spoken language, spoken Chinese language, has so many words that sound the same. And it's like your inflection makes mm-hmm. them different words, right? That phonetic would be really, really difficult
right.
because they look the same on paper without knowing what that inflection means.
Yeah.
So they need the logographic type of language to add that inflection, basically, mm-hmm. so that you understand what word it is that is meant when you write it down.
You can add a little tick here, a symbol.
Exactly.
There.
Yeah. I thought that was so cool. And it's really just like the genius of these people who developed these written languages to figure out how right. to make it work, you know?
Well, and we can see that problem too in our own language, English, though, you mm-hmm. know, for most people listening to this, you're obviously listening to it in English.
Right.
Yeah. And like, we have this problem driving the RV all the time because the word truck. Now, this isn't an inflection thing. It's more of a context thing.
Yeah.
But it's a similar idea, right?
Right.
If truck were spelled with a little bit of a doopy-doo on the U or something like that, or the K to symbolize that, hey, we mean like automobile truck.
Yeah.
Or we mean semi-truck.
We mean semi-truck, yeah.
We mean like delivery truck yeah. or commercial truck, I should say. Because yeah. every time we see, you know, truck parking or something like that, or truck wash, mm-hmm. it's like, okay, we can probably take our RV through there. But then you go across a border and it's like, trucks go here. Well, okay, we weigh 26,000 pounds and we're 36 feet long. Are we a truck?
Yeah, what do you guys count
context?
As truck?
and then weigh station's always like, I mean, I know I'm not supposed to go through a weigh station because I'm not commercial, but it does say trucks this way.
It does. And when we went into Canada, we were like, well, what is Canada considered truck?
Yeah, what's a truck in Canada?
Yeah, yeah.
It's stupid. Yeah.
so doopy-doo, like you said, would be
anybody,
a perfect way to distinguish that.
Anybody listening, you know, from any DOT right now, truck does not mean all trucks.
Right.
Because there are pickup trucks. There are, oh, you know, where do RVs fit in?
It's yeah.
Just, come on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fix your language. Anyway,
yeah.
These languages of China were so complex
yeah.
and difficult to master. They were, you know, often the language of the elite.
Yeah. You know? It remained the language of the elite. Like I said, until the mid 20th century, I think it was Mao Zedong who, you know, with communism,
yeah.
they wanted all people to be mm-hmm. able to read and write. So they really pushed a language that everybody could understand right. and learn. But until that point, it was such a class separator thing, right? And the more valuable members of society could read and write. And it mm-hmm. was just, it really increased class division. And it's just an integral part of Chinese society until yeah. communism came along.
Right,
so
right.
really crazy how much that influenced the whole society.
Right. And like many things in this world, trade and probably exploration and things mm-hmm. like that helped to spread this language out to neighboring regions.
Yep.
You know, the greater Chinese empire, so to speak.
Yeah. And kind of the reason why to our Western eyes, the Japanese, Korean, Vietnamese and other Asian scripts look kind of similar to Chinese. It's because they were mm-hmm. back how many thousands of years ago they were adopted from the Chinese script originally because yeah. it was the first one. And then it sort of spread out to these other Asian countries through traders and right. such. So, yeah.
Interesting thing about Japanese, because I really don't know a whole lot about Chinese other than what we just like studied. But mm-hmm. I took 2 years of Japanese in high school and Japanese has three written languages right now. You know, they all kind of sound the same when you're talking,
mm-hmm.
but three written languages. They've got kanji, which is their more logographic script.
It's okay.
more pictographic.
Uh-huh.
It's not really pictures anymore. It is symbols that represent concepts, though.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was kanji. They've got hiragana, which is their more syllabic
okay.
version of that
uh-huh.
for Japanese words. And then there's katakana, which is also a syllabic language, but used exclusively for foreign words.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
So like the word hamburger is written in katakana because it's not traditionally a Japanese word.
Do they mesh all these together? Like
oh,
if
yeah.
you're saying I want to go eat a hamburger at the restaurant.
You like could have three written systems
oh,
in the same sentence.
Wow. That is so yeah. complicated.
yeah.
Oh my gosh, language is just fascinating.
But they are distinctly different. Like kanji is like square symbols, really.
Okay.
And then the difference between hiragana and katakana is pretty striking if you know what you're looking for.
Uh-huh.
So you would know that. You would know just looking at it, even if you didn't know what the katakana word was, you would know it was a foreign word. Huh. Yeah.
That's so cool. I had no idea.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yep.
So, you know what else we don't have any idea about? Much of Mesoamerican and Mayan script.
Oh my God. Well, the one we're going to talk about, we know a little bit about.
A little bit about it. Yeah. But it's all just like big faces and teeth.
Oh,
let's see
man.
If we can decipher that.
Okay.
Back in a minute. What do you use for appointment and task scheduling? I used to constantly move things around in my calendar that were just tasks I needed to do in favor of meetings. Now I let an intelligent AI do that with Motion. In Motion, all I have to do is create tasks with a soft or hard deadline, state how long I think it will take, and whether it can be broken up, and Motion does the rest. It puts the task where it's a best fit for me getting it done by the deadline. The scheduler then puts appointments with people wherever they schedule and moves the tasks around them. Support the APN with a little kickback if you sign up and try Motion for free at www.arcpodnet.com/motion. That's arcpodnet.com/motion.
Did you know we have lots of great shows on the Archaeology Podcast Network? Head over to arcpodnet.com and you can see all the shows that are currently producing podcasts. Scroll down a bit more and you'll see some great shows from the past that still have great content. Search for your favorite shows on your podcasting app or listen right on the page at arcpodnet.com.
Welcome back to the final segment of episode 184 of the Archaeology Show. And we're talking about Mesoamerican and Mayan script this time.
Yeah.
And their 15 distinct writing systems that have been identified in pre-Columbian Mesoamerica.
Yep, that is a lot of different scripts. So,
yeah, and there's probably more.
Yeah, probably. And probably some of the ones that we think are in one category could actually be moved into another category because it's all very complicated.
And much like some girlfriends I've had, they're hard to date. So,
oh, wah. You want to know something crazy?
What?
You've only been in one relationship where you haven't broken up.
That is an interesting statistic. Where did we hear that? It was on some sort of a TV show.
Yeah, it was.
Have you ever been in a relationship that didn't end in failure?
Only the one.
Only the one.
So far, going good.
All right. Well, have you ever seen a writing system that didn't end in failure? Well, I mean, all the ones before this did.
Well.
All the ones before the one you're
I'm
using
not
now.
Sure, I would say failure, though. They just evolve into something
exactly,
new, right?
Exactly. So. But these Mesoamerican systems are, like I said, they're difficult to date and it's difficult to say which came first. But
yeah.
I think at some point we'll probably figure some of it out because there's really smart people out there and languages do evolve from not only the language itself and just it changes through time, sometimes just from people getting lazy and saying, I don't want to draw hieroglyphics anymore and scripting it out.
Yeah,
right. And sometimes just from a natural evolution and adding of things and then. As these reach out to other regions and they combine and things like that, you can kind of work back, you know, to the differences.
Yeah. So. Yeah, totally. So we definitely have a couple that are known to be some of the oldest, even though we don't really know which one is first. That would be the Olmec hieroglyphs, the Zapotec script and the Isthmian script. We know that they're some of the oldest because those cultures are some of the oldest in the Mesoamerica area. So that's how we know that. And we know some really cool things about Olmec specifically, which we will come back to that at the end of this segment. And we'll go into it in the bonus segment, too.
Oh,
so
my.
you gotta be a member to hear that. But so the Mayan script, of course, is the most extensive and the best known of the Mesoamerican scripts.
Yeah. The earliest examples of that date back to just 200 to 300 BCE.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is really interesting and tells you a little something about state society formation and stuff like that, because, you know, back in ancient Mesopotamia, Egypt, those areas, they were forming into state societies a few thousand years before this. And when you have that many people and that much governance taking place in China, too.
Yep.
When you have that many people and the need to govern
like
and
organize
control
them. Yeah.
You have to develop some kind of system of writing. And this just tells you that while there were people here, you know, up to, I mean, we know at least 10 to 15,000 years ago, it could be a lot longer. And they just didn't really
group,
need it.
Yeah. They just didn't group up into these larger societies. And it means that the language development was just a little bit slower. And that's just That's just what we know about the new world cultures. And
the, like all inventions, you invent what you need at the time. And if they didn't need it, they didn't need it.
Yeah, totally. So the Mayan script uses both logograms and symbols. And so far, there's been 700 different glyphs documented. And about 75% of them have been deciphered. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty good.
Yeah.
Pretty good odds right there. They were widely used across the area occupied by the Mayans, mm-hmm. and also across the entire time period, too.
Yeah, you would find these on altars, stelae, elements of architectural sculpture, mm-hmm. and especially around like doorways and stairs, which tells me there was probably a little bit of mysticism and maybe even identification going on. Like, this is my house.
Yes. Yeah, totally. Yeah. I think that was definitely happening. They could also be found painted or inscribed on pottery. Mm-hmm. And there's even examples of them being painted on cave walls and sometimes on the interior walls of buildings. Those are much less common, though. The walls in particular, I think because the walls like fall down over time or the plaster that they were painting them on is gone. So, you know, we just don't have a lot of examples of that. But can you imagine what one of those buildings would have looked like in the time? Just like covered in these beautiful painted glyphs, communicating whatever it was that they were communicating. I think that would have been so cool to see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it might not even have been communication necessarily, but dedication, recitation of a battle or, you know, the reign of an emperor or something like that. Yep, you know, that's usually what that kind of stuff was. There were shorter inscriptions as well, sometimes found on individual artifacts of like jade, greenstone, shell and bones, small things like that.
Yeah, they would carve this stuff anywhere.
Yeah, really. I mean, carve it was writing. Paint.
Yeah.
We do it now. Yeah. I think the smallest thing ever written, from what I remember, was it was a whole bunch of stuff, like an entire something or other written with like a scanning electron microscope on a piece of rice or something.
I was just going to say. So I don't know if these are still popular, but like when I was a teenager in the late 90s, early 2000s time frame, there was these little rice necklaces you could get and it would be like something, maybe just your name or whatever, inscribed on a piece of rice in this little like bottle thing that you would wear around your neck.
Right. It probably said you're a douchebag because nobody could read it.
It should have said that for sure.
It's like, thanks for your money, sucker. That's what I'd write on it.
Yeah, totally. Oh, my
that's
God.
That's like, I'm going to get you a rice name pellet, and also I'm going to name a star after you.
Oh, so sweet. Okay, so this is my favorite thing about the Mayans, because we didn't talk about this much in the development of other writing systems, but the Mayans actually had books.
Yeah.
They had screen fold volumes written on bark paper, typically in red and black ink.
Mm-hmm.
And these volumes mostly replaced the inscriptions actually on the monuments by the 9th century CE.
How did they save their place when they're reading those books that are written on bark paper? I think they would dog ear the pages.
Oh no. You're so stupid.
That must be where that comes from.
You think so, huh?
Well, and, I mean, if you're on bark paper, you have to dog ear the pages.
So dumb.
Couldn't stop.
Okay. We've only found three books and three that have survived the tropical climate. And also, zealous Spanish priests.
Yeah.
Apparently, when the conquest was happening, they would just burn them every time they found them to get rid of the books of the heathens or whatever, which is just insane.
Yeah. People always talk about like, what would you do if you go back in time? I'd kill Hitler, blah, blah, blah. You know, sure, that would help. Right. Mm-hmm. But also just like teach somebody in religion 1,000 years ago that burning books is probably not a great idea.
Yeah. And like you should preserve cultures and learn from them and try to work with them rather than just stamping them out violently. Like that's not going to be good for anybody.
Yeah, I mean, they burn these things because they don't want people like going back to their old ways, so to speak. But also, you know, it could also be argued that if you leave them around, they would see, I mean, thinking from the perspective of the priest, they might see that their old ways were, you know, savage and, you know, disorganized compared to the new way. But if you take that away, then they don't know what they had before,
right?
You know, historically, a couple generations down. And they might just go back to it. You know, who knows?
It's so short-sighted, too, because like half of the Christian holidays developed from pagan holidays. But like, you know, at a certain point, they just sort of forget that association with the pagan holidays. And no, these are totally Christian holidays. And if the fact that they can't look at the Mayan people and see that the same development could have happened is crazy. But that's just that's how zealots go. So
anyway, back to the script.
Yes.
They have some images that are I mean, literal representations of real objects.
Yeah.
Right. Much like hieroglyphics and other things like that, mm-hmm. which totally makes sense how writing would form. Like yeah. you see a thing, you want to represent that concept of that thing to another person.
You draw
the thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. The thing just becomes the language.
Mm-hmm. And there are also symbols that refer to objects or actions. And this can be like adjectives, prepositions, plurals, numbers. Like they were able to get so much of their spoken language into these different symbols.
I always forget prepositions. So that would be like place the sacrificial head on the altar.
It is anything an airplane can do to a cloud.
Stupid.
Over it, under it, through it, around it.
On it?
On it.
Yeah. Yep. So sacrifice the virgin on the altar would have been a preposition that they would represent within.
Except the Mayans didn't do that.
Oh,
so
yeah. Sorry.
Let's not be building the wrong.
When I listened to the Dirt podcast where they talked about the movie Apocalypto,
yeah.
which I don't think was Mayan, actually.
No, that was Aztec, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, it was
sure.
Aztec.
Yeah, because yeah. well, it was right where the Spanish.
Well, according to Mel Gibson, they're all the same.
Oh, my God. Let's take history lessons from Mel Gibson. That's a great idea.
Right.
Anyway, so there were also, okay, let me just recap here because we keep derailing ourselves.
Dog-ear this note here.
Oh, my God. We have images that are literal representations of objects. We also have symbols that refer to objects or actions. And then finally, we have phonetic glyphs that represent sounds like vowels or potentially the sound of a vowel and a consonant together mm-hmm. or even two consonants together. I'm thinking like the CH sound or something like that if they had a similar kind of thing. So they created glyphs to represent those sounds.
Right.
Very complex, right? I love it. Okay, so the way that Mayan script looks is that these signs and symbols were arranged into square blocks, right? Yeah. Mostly square blocks. And they're in these columns with two blocks next to each other. And then there'd be a small space and then two more blocks and then a small space, two more blocks. Mm-hmm. And then it's columns of these things, right? However, the way you read it is it's from the top left, horizontally, you go across two blocks, and then you go down and you read the next two blocks, and then you go down and you read the next two blocks, all the way down that column, and then you go back up to the top, and then it's two blocks, and then you go down like that.
Yeah, much like a newspaper.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, it is. It's in columns, but there's only two blocks per column.
Right.
It's so cool looking. I mean, I've seen it in like movies and images and stuff like that, but just looking at it from doing this research, the blocks themselves, they're so artistic. They're so beautiful and just so cool looking. Yeah. I love it.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Much like writing systems across the world, only a small elite group of people could actually read and write. Mm-hmm. Right. And what I want to know is, you know, you've got like stonemasons and stuff. I mean, sure, there's the books and there were probably a lot more than we even know of. If there's, you know, certain ones that are existing. They probably had them all the time. But again, it's a jungle environment. If it gets lost or forgotten, I mean, it'll probably just degrade pretty quickly in that environment.
Yeah.
So, but either way, the inscriptions and stuff, I wonder if the people who were the stonemasons and things that were creating these things even knew what they were doing, or if they were just literally given a drawing and saying, recreate this.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Who knows?
It could have been even, you know, in some of these societies that you weren't like allowed to even know the language.
Yeah.
You know?
It's interesting you say that, and it's escaping me which of these ancient languages that I researched did it, but they did have some like cleric type people didn't really understand the script. They were just copiers.
Yeah.
Like they were just there to copy
from
one thing to another. Or like you're saying, maybe the Masons just had like an image that they were given and they were just meant to copy it and they didn't really understand how to read it or how to form new inscriptions.
Right. And that's happened. I mean, that's happened time and time again in pretty much every society because before there were copy machines, there were copy people.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
totally.
The church is well known for that. Like, that's why there's a lot of versions of like Bible chapters because they were copied. They were translated into different languages. Mm-hmm. They were copied. And, you know, one clerk may have just like been a little sloppy.
Like a game of telephone.
I know it really is. Right. Yeah. And that's how changes happen and stuff like that. Yeah,
totally.
So
the writing was considered sacred, we think. And most of the inscriptions seem to be like histories of both the real world and also their mythologies, dedicating buildings and monuments to specific gods, that kind of thing. So there was definitely a lot of the sacred realm around these inscriptions.
Right.
But there were so many of them, And they're on everything. I just can't imagine that there wasn't some like everyday stuff in there too, but maybe we just haven't gotten to the point where we understand that stuff yet.
Yeah.
I don't know.
So that's pretty much the end of this episode. Mm-hmm. But like we said, there is a bonus episode. And if you're a member, arcpodnet.com/members, if you're not, but if you're a member, just go to the ad-free downloads page or click into Slack and you will see this.
And I'm so excited about it. So I'll give you just like a little bit of teaser here. It's called the Cascajal block, and it's an early writing system, Olmec probably. It was discovered in Mexico and it represents some of the oldest Mesoamerican writing. And anyway, there's a whole crazy story about how they found it and how they've deciphered it. So I'm really excited to talk about it. And
yeah,
you guys should totally go become members so you can hear all about it.
Indeed. So, and by the way, I mentioned last time as I was shaming Australia for not having any members of the Archaeology Podcast Network, it turns out we do have one.
Okay, good.
We don't collect that kind of information from our members,
right.
So I didn't actually know. But thank you, Greg, for being a member of the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Yeah, and shame on you for just throwing stuff out there without doing your research first.
Maybe sometimes it's just like, are people listening to this? And like 2 days after the episode, Greg comes into our Slack team and is like, hey, I'm in Australia. Sorry about that, Greg.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So anyway, if you're interested in becoming a member, again, it's $7.99 a month. You get stuff like our bonus content and bonus content from other shows and, you know, past recordings of live events that we do.
Yep.
And then also anything else we do related to membership, plus the Slack team, which is really cool. And there's some active people over there that are really having discussions at the end of like a lot of different episodes from the CRM Arc podcast, Archaeotech, this show, you know, and a few others. There's some really good discussions happening back there. So if you're interested in keeping that conversation going and seeing what other people think, also talking to people like us, the hosts, I just got to get Rachel back there. She never goes to Slack, but
I know I'm on other Slack channels like all day long.
I know,
like the idea of going to one more Slack.
I mean, I hear you. I'm on like 19 Slack teams.
I know.
Yeah.
Slack's a lot, but it's such a great communication tool.
It is. And it's free. Yep. So, and it's included with your membership. All right. Well, with that, I think we will go explore Glacier National Park and hopefully have something to talk about on this show, especially after that tour that we're going to do on Tuesday.
I'm excited for that.
Yeah. All right, we'll see you guys later.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at arcpodnet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Culturo Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Rachel Roden.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
This is Chris Webster, founder of the APN and one of the chief editors. Thanks for listening all the way to the end. If you want to keep the conversation going and support us along the way, go to arcpodnet.com/members. That's arcpodnet.com/members. And thanks for listening.